everyone. Welcome to Garden Fork Radio. You're here with Rick and Eric. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Eric.
It's good to hear from you.
It's good to hear your voice.
But today we each have a couple things we want to talk about. But I think the first thing is that you have a new pup.
I do. He's a new rescue. His name is Darcy. Mostly, I'd like to talk about the amazing world of rescue. All these volunteers and people that put in enormous amounts of time. Darcy is a mixed terrier breed. His ears are upright and kind of orange. I sent you a picture.
Yeah.
You can put it in the show notes. His ears are kind of orange like a Norfolk Terrier, and his hair is very silky. He doesn't have the double coat of a Karen or a Westie. So he's like a silky terrier, but he also has a very pointed face like a fox and kind of a long tail. So he's just a terrier mix of some sort. But he was discovered by accident down in Houston. He was in a kill shelter down there. They keep him for 48 hours. And the Westie rescue people were there picking up a Westie that they'd seen online. And they spotted him, and Darcy only had maybe half a day or so to live. And so they went ahead and pulled him and let Karen Rescue USA know about it. And they said, sure, we'll take him. And 24 hours later, Darcy and six other dogs are in a private pilot's plane. He's flying up to Dallas, and they're dropping these dogs off, and he has business up there. And that's kind of how this works. If we can find travelers or people associated with our organizations, I transport a lot of dogs out of here. And go ahead.
So I mean, the backstory is your last pup recently passed away, and there was this kind of void, I think, in the home there. Yeah.
Oh yeah. It was a hard winter for our dogs. Sydney passed early part of the winter. She was maybe 16 or 17. Zeke, a little younger, 13. He passed just a few months ago and, had a brain tumor. And so, instead of sitting around and, kind of mourning them, I decided I wanted to get right back up on the horse, and I started looking for a dog.
And there you go. So then, how did you find out about Darcy?
Well, I'm part of the Karen Rescue USA group, and they put him on the website. And I said, I'm really kind of interested in that dog. How do we get him up here? And five different families relayed Darcy from Dallas up to Chicago, on vacation trips and business trips and whatnot. And then I drove over to Chicago, and I carried not all terriers, but I carried like four dogs out of the Virginia Beach area and dropped them in Richmond and in Charlotte and that kind of, a couple other places along the way, and picked him up in Chicago, and then we drove back together.
That's great.
Yeah, so that's the way rescue works, a lot of people helping out. Generally, I'm not a big fan of breed-specific rescue.
Yeah.
I like to see all animals rescued. But terriers in particular, they're just kind of a whole different breed of dog, in a way. And if we match them with the wrong kind of people, the wrong temperament, you can do a lot of damage, and you'll never get a lot of good out of the terrier. So I like terrier rescue particularly, which is kind of strange. I mean, they're kind of like two different kinds of people. There are salarymen, who will do what you want for a salary, and they trust at the end of the month they'll get a check.
Yep.
And then there are independent contractors like you. And they'll only take the jobs they want, and they'll only do them when they want to do them. They're going to do them their way, and they'll do them on their timeline, and they expect to be paid immediately. Well, terriers are essentially independent contractors of the dog world. And if you pair them up with a sit Nazi of some sort, the dog and the owner both are going to be real unhappy. So it's kind of nice to get the pairings right on the back end of it. But he is a real challenge. He is just a strange mix of a dog. He is housebroken and extremely affectionate, but he's also extremely wary and has a tremendous fear of being caught. He got away from me one day. He was in the right-hand side of on the seat of my truck. And all the way back, I had been careful to keep him tied to something in the car, because we've had that happen on a few rescue trips. Not me, but other people have opened the door to get gas, and the dog leaps out and then takes off across the highway. And so we didn't want that to happen. But this time I really hadn't thought about it, and had him in the car or in the truck. And he was sitting in the right-hand seat, and I had my left window down. And at the stop sign, he bails through the window, didn't touch me or the windowsill. Wow. Just an amazing little athlete.
But you got him back.
I finally chased him, and, you know, kind of trailed him back to the house. He guided him in a way by chasing him. He didn't fall for any of the usual tricks, running away from him, laying on the ground, you know, begging him, throwing him treats. Finally, we got close enough to the house that I was able to duck in, get a couple of pill pockets, and then this med that we gave our other dogs for fireworks whenever they were really bothered by fireworks. And so we just kind of put them to sleep for a few hours. And stuffed that in the pill pocket, went back out. And I had one smart thing I had done. Of course, Darcy is chipped. He has a microchip, so they can be identified.
Yeah, my dogs are chipped. Yep.
Yeah, but I put one of those new trackers, T-R-A-C-K-R, mm-hmm. on him. And it's Bluetooth enabled. And then with my cell phone, was able to pinpoint what direction he was going. And tracked him down from there, using just following him on my Apple cell phone, my iPhone, and tracked him down, tossed him the pill pockets, and he gobbled them right down. And about 3 minutes later, he was fast asleep, and I picked him up and brought him home. So he's been a real challenge. He's skittish, but he's getting better. But he's going to be a great little dog, and I love a challenge, and I love terriers a lot.
That's cool that you're using some technology there and some veterinary pharmaceuticals. So
yeah, you know, one of the nice things about Tracker is if we live in a fairly tracker dense area, if you go on their website, you can actually see them demonstrate how they put one under the seat of a bicycle, let it be stolen. And then several days later, they tracked it down. And they did that because whenever you pass a tracker-enabled phone with a tracker, it will log it.
It pings it. Yeah.
It pings it. And so it began developing this pattern of pings about where it is, what neighborhood. And then you get in close, and then you begin to connect to it with your Bluetooth, and you can find it. And the guy walked right up to the door where the fence where his bicycle reportedly had been stolen, and recovered it. So it has a lot of good uses. It's an interesting technology, but it really helped me catch Mr. Darcy that time.
Good for you. You know, we haven't really talked about it on the podcast, but we have a new Garden Fork Facebook group. It's not the page, it's our group. It's a discussion group. And one person posted a picture of her dog, and I think 100 more people have replied with pictures of their dogs.
Yeah, I put Darcy up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you go to Garden Fork, type in Garden Fork, or just type in Garden Fork, it'll show up. It's Garden Fork Q&A. It's a closed group, and I kept it closed so we wouldn't get spammers. So you have to be approved to join. You just ask to join, and we say yes, we won. And that way, it's kind of a spam-free place on Facebook for all the Garden Fork people to post pictures, ask questions. Scott, our friend Scott, who's a Patreon supporter, is building a treehouse, and he posted a drawing, and he asked me for feedback, and that was really cool.
Yeah. You know, I haven't been up there recently because of all the work with
Darcy.
But, you know, the discussions are really in-depth and interesting, and there was one about planting walnuts, and it went on for a very long time. A lot of great information came out of that.
Yeah, who'd have thought? You know, I thought, well, let's, and I thought about it for like a year, and I was like, oh yeah, I should just do this thing, you know.
Well, it's working out really great, and you know, it grew so fast. You know, I try to help you as best I can with that, to just, you know, approve and just, you know, whatnot, but I was just amazed how quickly it's grown. Well, you have about 600 members now?
Yeah, all through just kind of word of mouth. I sent out to the email list too, so right. That helped. But not bad.
Yeah, it's really great. You know, one last thing about Darcy, and then I'll get off my horse. But one of the things we found out he can do, one, he's a terrier, so he digs. And we were prepared for that. We thought we had him, had our yard locked down after owning four different terriers. But he managed to find a place to dig, and so I had to figure out how to fix that. But he's also a fence climber, and he climbs up fences. Ours is kind of a basket weave because of the hurricanes and strong winds in the area.
Yeah,
you want to be sure to let as much air as you can through, and he will climb right up to the top of it. And so now I've had to go buy rolls of wire, 5 foot tall, and I tack it on at the 4 foot level and then bend it so that there's a foot of wire on the ground, and then I cover it in mulch so he can't, he doesn't really know it's there. But then to defeat his climbing, the holes in the wire are 2x3, and I went down 6 inches or two holes and bent it out at a 45 degree at the top.
Wow.
And so essentially I've had to create almost like a, you know, you see this kind of thing at a prison.
Yeah.
keep him from going over the top. And so terriers are challenging. That's all I can say. I love him like he's a sweet little dog. But all of rescues have baggage, and he's brought his own.
That's great you're doing that. You know, the Labrador, you want him to come back, you just show him a tennis ball, you know?
Exactly. You know, and most dogs are geared toward, you know, food or something. And he's really, this little terrier is not food driven at all. He is prey driven, however, and fear driven. And when he gets in a panic, he stops thinking, he stops listening, and he has a real fear of people towering over him. And people trying to catch him. So I don't know what his backstory is, but we will heal him eventually. And he's going to be a great dog.
Cool. You want to go on something completely different?
Let's do.
I listen to podcasts while I'm exercising in the basement. And I was listening to Serial. I really like that one.
Right.
And I was like, well, what other kind of, I don't know if it's called true crime or documentary, detective, I wouldn't call it mystery.
Investigative reporting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's one from the Canadian Broadcasting Company called Someone Knows Something.
You're listening to Someone Knows Something from CBC Radio. In 1972, 5-year-old Adrian McNaughton vanished while on a fishing trip in eastern Ontario. Documentarian David Ridgen goes back to the small town he grew up in, searching for answers.
Well, I can't tell you very much because I just don't remember a whole lot of back then.
I just wish, David, you had been around doing this a few years earlier, when our memory was a bit better.
Barb McNaughton lost her son, Adrian.
But I almost don't want to talk about it because I don't want to relive it. I think I have it tucked to the back of my mind, and I don't think of it every day, but every so often I'll go to say something and I'll say, Adrian.
He couldn't tie his shoes, he was only 5. So he would have lost his shoes in that bush, it was very thick. Bad things happen to little boys sometimes. And that's what we figured happened, because there was just no sign of anything anywhere. And there had to have been.
And it's about the disappearance of a young boy when he and his family went on a fishing trip up in Canada. And again, it's kind of, I kind of relate to it because Wisconsin is like Canada, and we would go on trips like this where there's just lakes in the mountains and the woods, you know, and you drive up a dirt road and only a couple people in town know about it, kind of thing. And this happened in the 1970s, I believe. And this 5-year-old disappeared, and now a radio documentarian from the CBC who is familiar with that town is doing a kind of a one-man documentary about it. I mean, he does have some production support, but I haven't listened to the whole show yet. I haven't listened to the end, but right now they're using some cadaver dogs to search the area, and it's very interesting. And it's not as, I wouldn't use the word slickly produced, but polished maybe as like the serial was, the serial show. But it is really well done, and I've really liked listening to it, and I only let myself listen to it when I'm exercising.
See? Yeah. I listen to podcasts all the time, and I'm actually trying to break that habit because I'm finding that I stop doing things just so I can listen to more podcasts, and so I need to work a little harder at creating my own content. But, yeah, another great podcast I've been listening to, though, is Home of the Brave.
It was summer. I bought a canoe, tied it to the top of my station wagon, and drove north to Wyoming, to the Green River Lakes in the Wind River Mountains. That's where the Green River begins.
I have to confess a profound ignorance about what I'm doing. My preparation for this float trip consisted of buying a canoe and then grabbing a Wyoming road map from a rest stop on the drive up. I'd been in a canoe a couple of times, and I thought I knew how to make it turn and go straight. And I'd seen the river from several bridges I'd crossed on other trips in other years, and it was always wide and calm and flat, so I thought I could manage well enough. I could have practiced with the canoe, gone out with someone who could show me the strokes, and I could have read up on the river, learned about what was in store for me, but I chose not to do these things. When you try to lay things out, try to control what's going to happen, you always end up disappointed or frustrated. At least I do.
And he is an independent, kind of like the people doing, you know, the guy doing the CBC one. But occasionally you'll hear him on This American Life or something. One of his stories will make it. But he has a bunch of stories that are just fascinating that, you know, he produces by himself. And it's real interesting. So just kind of look up Home of the Brave, see if you like that one.
All right. Yeah, because I need more, you know, just for the drive from New York up to the house on Friday nights. I mean, I listen to some of the more popular ones, but I want to find out the more indie people and support them.
You know, I try not to listen to too much NPR, particularly podcast, CBC occasionally, BBC every now and then, Radio National, which is the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, has some interesting podcasts. But I really look for the independents and the people trying to make it on their own. One, because they're interesting.
Yeah.
And have a different voice, a different take. But, you know, I'm leaning more toward the stories and even thinking about more audio books lately. Some reason during the summer, I tend toward audio books and away from straight podcast.
Cool. I was what got me kind of into this was I watched that documentary on Netflix called The Making a Murderer.
Oh, yeah.
Which I don't want to go into because everyone has different, very strong feelings about it. But what I did love was it was basically made by two women, and it took them 10 years. They barely had any backing. They did get some grants, you know, from arts and humanities organizations. And they basically moved from New York to Wisconsin to work on it. And I thought it was really, whatever your feelings about who did what, I thought it was pretty well done, and considering how little money they had. And then Netflix picked it up, and they did polish around the edges. But that got me started on this, oh, what's other kind of investigative reporting going on kind of thing. Another documentary series I've been watching is by Michael Pollan, who is like the food, I guess you call him the food guy of the West Coast. And it's called Cooked. And I was happily surprised about it. I mean, I think a lot of people maybe put this label on him, but he's like, I think is incredibly smart and has investigated a lot about how we interact with food. He's gone out and, you know, he's killed and hunted his own food to see what that is like. But this is a documentary that's, first of all, it's beautifully shot, but he talks about the elements of cooking.
We all have powerful memories of being cooked for. That act of generosity and love, I think, is still in there for most of us and is very powerful. The meal is this incredible human institution. When we learn to cook is when we became truly human. But we've lost touch, I think, with how that food got to our plates. I was going to do kind of a deep dive into cooking and learn how to do it. I started with fire because that's where cooking begins.
If you eat meat like this, you find out how good, really good meat is.
We're taking things that aren't immediately delicious and working flavor into them.
If someone says, you shouldn't eat gluten, I would say, well, prove it.
A decomposition creating wonderful flavor. It's a promise of something better.
This is more important than people realize. When you let a corporation cook your food, they cook differently than people do. You have an industry that is trying to undermine cooking as an everyday practice.
And if I lose that tradition of cooking, I've actually lost knowledge.
For me, it's sort of like a rite of passage that was taught to me by my grandfather and my father, and taught to them by their parents.
In a kernel of grain, there's everything to support a whole life.
Is there any practice less selfish?
My mother did this.
Any time less wasted than preparing something delicious and nourishing for the people you love.
And he touches on fermentation, on bread baking, to the point where they're out in the Australian outback hunting lizards with the Aboriginals. And I just think it's really well done. And it's on Netflix. So if you have a Netflix account, it's free to check out. And it's just, you know,
I thought I knew everything Michael had done, but I'm gonna watch for this. You know, one of my favorite non-food books that he did was called A Place of My Own. And it was about building his own writer's shack. And that was when he was actually on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun. But this sounds like a great movie. You know, really what he writes about is the kind of symbiotic relationship between people and food, and or people and plants,
yep,
particularly. And that's one of the things I really like. What was it? Biology of Desire?
He's prolific.
Yeah, he writes a lot, but it's really interesting how we kind of need each other, and we, you know, in fact, there's even a what was the name of that book? Well, we'll look at it later, maybe next time. A guy wrote about urban fauna, about animals and plants and stuff in the urban environment and how wild it really is. And he wrote about pigeons and ginkgos and coyotes and all kinds of things that are in our urban environment and how we live off of each other in a way.
Yeah, we have ginkgos here, and you got to watch out for the ginkgo fruit.
Oh, yeah. But his point was that whatever animal spread the ginkgo seed died off thousands of years ago, and that it's humans that have been keeping the ginkgo alive. The only wild grove of ginkgo is a couple of valleys in somewhere in China.
Yeah, the ginkgo is popular as an urban tree because it's very resilient to salt.
Ah, yeah, well, up there, that'd be particularly useful.
Yeah, they're also beautiful, especially in the fall. They turn a beautiful golden color, and they're a real resilient tree. But the goal is to plant males because the female has this fruit that drops, and when that drops on the sidewalk, it's almost like a real mushy peach, a small mushy peach with a hard nut in the middle. And man, does that flesh stink!
Yeah, and I've heard if it drops on your car, it takes the acid takes the paint off, but or at least the shine.
I don't know.
We have a few around here, but fortunately, we have different kinds of invasive species, so everybody plants those instead.
Neat. We also, I just wanted to thank our Patreon supporters. I was able to buy a new portable hard drive because of the monthly supporters. I got a 1 terabyte LaCie drive. It's one of those kind with the, it looks like a big giant orange rubber band around it.
Oh, I've seen that.
And that'll allow me to carry my photo library back and forth, you know, wherever I'm working. Because whenever I work on the website or a video, I always need an image. And I was keeping them just on the big computer in New York. And I'd be like, oh, I need that. I need some pictures and I don't have them here. So I couldn't get any work done. So I bought this thanks to our Patreon supporters. And it's a USB 3 1 terabyte LaCie drive. And it is great. So I'm really happy about that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you,
everyone who contributes. Yeah.
I don't have anything else. Do you, Rick?
You know, not really. Other than, unless you wanted to talk about hugging dogs.
Yeah, why don't you let us know about that?
There is a study, now that I've said it, I have to go find it real quick. I was going to link to an NPR article about it, but a researcher at Psychology Today at their blog posted that a lot of dogs don't like to be hugged, and he deduced this by looking at 250 pictures of people hugging dogs on Google and Flickr, and then trying to apply his animal behavioral science background to the way the dog was reacting. And in his opinion, dogs are, technically they call them cursorial animals. Their first line of escape or defense is escape. They want to run. They don't bare their teeth. They don't try to stand and fight. And so whenever you inhibit that, in the wrong situation or with the wrong person, the dog will show certain signs of stress. And you can see this in the pictures, and the stress very often appears as the dog looking away from whatever's stressing it, and sometimes even half closing its eyes, like it's trying not to see it. And the next stage is what they call whale eye, where the dog, you can begin to see the whites of their eyes, and they begin to look a little disturbed. And that's actually a good sign to leave the dog alone. Dog handlers and dog behavioral people will tell you that once you begin to see that, what they call whale eye, where you can see the whites of their eyes, and you normally don't see that with the dogs, something's about to happen. And the reason this is really important is that most child bites from the dog are right at this point, when a child, particularly an unknown child, is hugging a dog, and the dog becomes stressed, and he'll show these signs or she'll show these signs, but you need to be aware of them, because this is the reason most children get bit. And so even with friendly dogs that are otherwise completely docile, they feel like they're being inhibited from running away, and they're frightened. Now, there's been a lot of complaints on the different articles I've read from dog owners saying, my dog loves to be held and to be hugged. And that's when the dog is interested in being hugged.
Yeah. So I've seen that with mine. There's some kids, our neighbor kids, come over and they try and hug the dog. And I'm like, don't do that. And I can just tell that my dogs don't like, oh, why? I'm like, just don't hug them like that.
Yeah. You pet the dog, you stick out your hand, let them sniff you. But you really shouldn't hug them until you really get to know them. And even, owners, under the wrong circumstances, if the dog is wound up and you try to hug it, will, display these same, signs of stress, because the dog, feels, that he needs to be in the defensive mode, which in this case is being a cursorial animal and running away. But, it's things to watch for and help you prevent dog bites, particularly of little kids.
There you go. So this is like the dog show.
It is. But, it beats being the bee show.
Yeah.
Which, it grinds on several of our listeners occasionally.
That's okay. We'll talk about bees next time. So,
my tomato starts are up and they're doing great. I got one swarm, but I gave it away.
I saw that. You put that on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
The group, sorry.
Yeah. The question and answer group. But I just had too much on my plate, and she came out and helped me, and she didn't have any bees. And I said, she's a new beekeeper. And I said, well, here, you take these home and put them in a hive.
Good for you.
Well, just I enjoy the catching and the, you know, the I've already had the our my truck set up as the swarm mobile.
Yeah. There goes that guy.
Yeah. Just waiting for somebody to call. But I had a lot of false calls this year. I think I had maybe, I don't know, I've had 7 or 8 now, where it was ground bees or wasps or hornets or something, but they weren't honeybees.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion. People kind of lop honeybees in with everything else that has a wing. So, all right, well, cool. I think that'll wrap it up for today. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Garden Fork's theme music is used under license from UniqueTracks.com.